Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
Free for all Friday. Free for all Friday. It is free for all Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today is pretty random. I'll just start with something random. I'm in a bit of a rut. Well, I'm not in a rut, but I feel like I'm at the end of a really long marathon. Before I get into more complaints, welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, we talk apologetics, theology, how to explain and defend our Catholic faith. If you're listening to this podcast on iTunes or Google Play, consider leaving a review. If you're watching this on YouTube, consider subscribing. If you're listening and haven't been to the YouTube channel yet, be sure to go there. We have a lot of other great videos, not just podcast episodes, rebuttal videos. I'll be posting my debate with Matt Dillahunty and a debrief of that debate probably next week. So we got a lot of great content on the YouTube channel, not just Council of Trent episodes. And I want to do more of that. Like, I want to do more rebuttal videos. I want to do more writing. Like I feel like I'm just like on the precipice of finishing many other important. Does that ever happen to you? Like, you see the thing that you're really excited to do, but there's another good thing you're working on right now and you've enjoyed it, but now it's time for it to move to the side for the other things to take its place. Well, basically, so right now I'm actually teaching three courses at Homeschool Connections. Homeschool Connections is really awesome. Just go to homeschoolconnections.com. You can sign up high school students, high school homeschoolers, to take a variety of courses taught by people. And I'm actually teaching three classes right now on Introduction to the New Testament, one on the Gospels, one on the Pauline Epistles, and one on everything else, which I call Acts of the Apostles and the Catholic Letters. And it's been really great. The students ask great questions. And what I do actually is I film half the lecture, I film beforehand for the students to watch. And then the other half of the lecture is just straight up Q&A time. So I think it's super efficient. And I've really enjoyed doing it. But I guess I didn't think, like, wow, teaching three full-length classes on top of everything I do at Catholic Answers, podcasts and writing and interviews and all kinds of stuff, might be a bit much. But it's great. And I mean, I've always told people, you know, people say, Trent, how do you get into apologetics? How do you learn more about the faith? I've always said the two books you should read are the New Testament and the Catechism. So if you have a high school student that wants to go deeper in this area and wants to be in a class with me where they can have Q&A and personalized attention, then you have two options. I have six classes, three of them under the rubric Introduction to the Catechism and three under Introduction to the New Testament. If you do all three classes, you go the whole New Testament, whole Catechism. They're available as recorded courses at homeschoolconnections.com, but I will be taking a limited number of signups. I'm going to start doing it live starting next fall. So next fall, spring, and the following fall, I'll do three semesters. Catechism 1, 2, 3, New Testament 1, 2, 3. The classes max out at 25 students. So if you would like to study that with me for three semesters, you'll go through the whole Catechism or the whole New Testament or both. If you'd like to sign up for that, check that out at homeschoolconnections.com. So I'm finishing my first round of teaching the course now. I'm teaching three of the New Testament courses concurrently. So it's actually been a lot. It's been great, but I'm excited. The semester is now coming to an end, and I'm excited now the stuff I've created for the course to be able to debut it again next fall for people who want to sign up for the live course. Awesome. If you want to do the recorded course, if you're not able to sign up for the live course in the fall, if it sells out, you can always watch the recorded courses that I've previously done on that. Or those lectures, Introduction to the Catechism, they're actually available if you're a premium subscriber at trenthornpodcast.com. So as little as $5 a month, you get lots of bonus content. You get to watch my Introduction to the Catechism series, and then eventually that's going to turn into the Introduction to the New Testament series. I offer that for my patrons at trenthornpodcast.com, because without you, the podcast wouldn't be possible. So today, I am doing something fun for my patrons. A lot of times, another perk of being a patron at trenthornpodcast.com is you get to submit questions for open mailbag episodes. So I do a variety of open mailbag episodes. Sometimes I do open mailbag atheism, open mailbag about the Bible, lots of different great subjects. So I thought it'd be cool to do random open mailbag. And I opened the floor for any topic. Now, what's interesting is I thought a lot of people would just want me to answer kind of random stuff. And a fair number of people kind of asked me random non-religious questions. But a lot of people, there were still many great questions about the faith that were submitted. So I will happily oblige. I mean, a Catholic apologist, what am I supposed to do here, right? Build people up in the faith. But we can talk about fun stuff as well. So these are the questions that were submitted. If you'd like to submit questions for a future episode, go to trendhornpodcast.com and sign up there, and you'll get an opportunity to do that. So without further ado, let us jump into the questions. As a very green Catholic, the whole Vatican II controversy confuses me. What is your take on the conflict between those in general opposition to Vatican II and those who support it? How far can a faithful Catholic go in denying the validity of post-Vatican II masses, documents, and other resulting structures? Well, there are certain things you clearly can't do. You can't say Vatican II was not a legitimate ecumenical council. You can't say that the documents of Vatican II do not have authority over Catholics. They require the religious submission of mind and will. So they're not infallible declarations, but the vast majority of church teaching is not an infallible declaration. That's only done at specific instances in councils or papal declarations, like the dogmatic declaration about the infallible declaration about Mary's assumption into heaven, for example. But it's a valid ecumenical council, one that requires our assent to its authority. And the new mass that came out of Vatican II, you have to recognize it is a legitimate mass, that Jesus is on the altar when the mass is performed validly. And even people I know who are more fans of the Latin or the Tridentine mass will generally admit these core basic things. If you don't admit that, you've got serious problems, and you're sliding headfirst into schism and sedevacantism and all other kinds of really bad errors. I think really more where the debate is, it's about feelings about the Second Vatican Council and how it was implemented. And I will be honest, this is something I am interested in, but it's not something I've spent a lot of time debating or studying or engaging others on, because it's sort of on the peripheries of my goal as an apologist, which is to bring Jesus to people who don't have Jesus and bring the Catholic Church to people that don't have Catholicism, and help people to turn away from grievous moral errors like abortion, same-sex relations, things like that. I think there can be a legitimate debate about, one, the implementation of the teachings of the Second Vatican Council. You always know this. You'll hear people say, are we allowed to do this? Is this okay? It's part of the spirit of Vatican II. For one Halloween, I should find the picture and I'll post it for my patrons, or I'll post it on my social media. For one Halloween, I dressed up as a ghost with a bunch of like liturgical errors and things like that pinned to my ghost outfit. And I called myself the spirit of Vatican II. Like, ooh, the scariest thing for Halloween, the spirit of Vatican II. So I think there's a legitimate debate that can be had about how the Second Vatican Council was implemented and what happened after that. And there can be a legitimate debate about the council documents itself. Just because something is church teaching doesn't mean it's always articulated in the best way. You know, there could be ways the council documents are phrased that, you know, frankly, could have been phrased better or more clearly. You could say that about church documents all throughout history. I think people can have legitimate debate about that. And some people will say, well, look at, they'll look at a graph of church attendance, mass attendance, and you'll start to see it plummet after Vatican II. Well, actually, it starts to go down before the Second Vatican Council. And so some people make the simplistic error, the fallacy, after, therefore, because of. So mass attendance declines after the Second Vatican Council, therefore the Second Vatican Council is the reason mass attendance and baptisms take a dramatic dive. Well, no, that'd be a fallacy to make that kind of a simple argument, because during that same time period, all major denominations experienced declines in church membership as well. The 1960s ushered in the sexual revolution, modern postmodernism. Time magazine back in the 60s had a very famous cover. It was very controversial, called "Is God Dead?" on this 1960, this is like 1966 Time magazine cover, Is God Dead? And that a lot of theologians were kind of articulating a theology where God was really just a symbol or a metaphor. It didn't really have any real existence. So it's clearly not just the Second Vatican Council. But at the same time, I do think there is merit to the argument that the dramatic changes that took place, whether it was through the council or a faulty implementation, did result in Catholics losing a sense of their identity. So I think Stephen Bullivant has written an excellent book on the Second Vatican Council, where he says it's kind of a both and, that there's a decline in religion that's not due to the council, but the council may have accelerated some of these things. It's an interesting debate to be had. I just don't think it's something that we should lose our identities over or become jaded or cynical. We should take from the past what works well, repeat it. What doesn't work well, learn from those mistakes, especially when it's even when it's Catholic teaching. So I hope that is helpful, and we'll see if that makes anybody upset. Hey, Trent, I've been a follower of Ravi Zacharias, and he has helped me in mounting an intellectual response to many questions that my atheist friends, skeptics, raise. The news about his sexual failures are very disturbing. I found it hard to deal with hearing this kind of news about someone I used to respect. Yeah, so Ravi Zacharias is a very popular Christian apologist. He did a lot with atheism and relativism. So he was a Protestant. I believe he was born in India, and then he came over to the United States, became a well-known apologist. Some of the scandals of Ravi Zacharias is not just a sex scandal, that he was texting women, that he was having affairs, that he was threatening to harm himself if the affairs came to light. But he was involved in other behavior. There is a book, there is actually, I think he's an atheist who has done a lot of investigative work on Ravi Zacharias. I forget the name of him, but if you look up Atheist Investigates Ravi Zacharias, I'm sure you'll find it. It's like something, Scandal in the Kingdom. It's not coming to me right at the moment. But there's other things, like Ravi seems to have been involved in credential inflation. So saying things like he was a scholar at Oxford, when all that meant was he was like taking a class at Oxford, or that he has spoken at Oxford or these other big universities, when what really happened was the Christian Union rented out a room for him to speak. I mean, I've been to really big campuses, and you know, I've been invited by the students there to speak, but not by the university. Sometimes, though, I have been invited by representatives of the university. At the University of California in Berkeley, for example, it was members of the faculty who invited me to come and debate Malcolm Potts in one of his classes. So I think it'd be fair of me to say that I was invited by UC Berkeley to go and debate Malcolm Potts, for example, and that I've done debates on university campuses. But you always have to be careful. So, I mean, obviously the sex scandal stuff is terrible, and it shows it's not just a Catholic problem, it's a human problem. You see it everywhere. Also, you know, we see these scandals of people falling. You know, you just have to be careful about putting people on a pedestal. Anybody, even me, you know, I'm only human. I make mistakes often, you know, and so I would hope to not make mistakes like this, but our faith in the church, in the Catholic Church, does not rest on the impeccability of anyone. There have been popes even that have done whoppers of misdeeds, fathered children. There's one pope who sold the papacy to another pope, to another guy, and then got it back later. One pope dug up his old predecessor from the grave to put him on trial. I think it was all like in the 11th century. Well, the pope who sold the papacy was a few hundred years later. But the fact of the matter is, Christ's church flourishes not because of our holiness, but in spite of our sinfulness. If anything, the evidence of the Holy Spirit working in the church is its ability to flourish in spite of the defects of its members. Present company included. So, you know, don't just be careful. It's fine to have people to look up to. It's fine to have mentors and others to learn from. Just prepare yourself that everybody's only human. And if somebody falls, don't fall with them. You know, don't fall with them. Pray for them and recognize it's a sinful world. We're in a battle out there, and we have to keep fighting the good fight. So something to always be careful about. Now, here's our next one. Through the lens of Catholic theology in a zombie apocalypse like Shaun of the Dead, is it okay to kill someone who's been bitten and is becoming a zombie, like a mercy killing, like when David wanted to kill Sean's mom. Okay, this is interesting. So let's take, zombification, and this would be Shaun of the Dead zombies. So there's two types of zombies, right? And if you look in movies, there are I guess there's more than two types, but you have the slow, shambling zombies and the fast-running zombies. You also have the kind of magical zombies that can stay alive even though they're basically a skeleton. Like, how could they be walking around? They're totally decomposed. And the 28 days later zombies that are human beings that have been driven into a crazy rage. So they're more like realistic zombies, and they don't last as long. Like the Romero zombies I think it was Land of the Dead or Day of the Dead, where one of them walks across a river. They walk underneath the river and to the other side. So they're like kept alive by magic. You know, they're not. You know. So anywho, zombies. Is it okay to kill someone? Is it okay to kill a zombie? Let's just start with that. Is it okay? Let's say we live in a zombie universe. Your loved one has died. Their soul is separated from their body, and yet their body has come back to life somehow. Their body has been reanimated and is trying to bite you and turn you into a zombie. I would say totally okay to go for the headshot there, my friend. I mean, even this would be a clear case of self-defense. You're not intending anyone's death. Not that you're not intending anyone's death, but the death of this person is not possible. You can't kill the undead. So killing a human being is wrong because we don't have a right to take a human life. And what death is separating the soul from the body. So we don't have the right to intentionally do that to an innocent person, okay? God has the rights over life and death. So if someone's soul left their body, but their corpse, now a corpse should still be treated with respect, but it does not have the same rights as a human being. So if someone's corpse became a threat to other people, then you could take action against that corpse in order to protect other people. So this, in a realistic scenario, let's say somebody's corpse has a deadly pathogen, you don't want people to get sick, you could dispose of it as humanely as possible, but you don't have to show it the same dignity and respect as you would the actual person. So if the corpse is reanimated and tries to bite you, go for the headshot there. If the person is turning into a zombie, though, I would say they are still alive. And just to spare them the suffering involved in dying, the church's teaching on euthanasia and assisted suicide would still apply here. So I would say that if someone is turning into a zombie, they are not even a threat yet. They still have control over their rational abilities. You could not kill them. You could lock them in a room. And then after they have died and only their corpse remains and is reanimated by some weird thing, whether it's magic or a demon or I don't know how you would explain it, basically. Then you would be right to use lethal force there. That would be in the case of the magical zombies or the Romero zombies that are animated, walking, decaying corpses. 28 days later, zombies are a little bit different. These are human beings who have their souls. They have just been infected with something like a rage virus that destroys their rational abilities and turns them into attackers who have no conscious sense of themselves. In that case, killing would be justified in self-defense. You're not intending the person's death, but you have the right to defend yourself and defend your life against this aggressor, and you should only use the force that is necessary to neutralize the aggressor. So if you can lock them in a room, if you can incapacitate them from moving, you should take any nonviolent steps you can, but if lethal force is your last option, then I would say you would be justified in that case, even if they are alive, they have a soul and a body. But in this case, you're not intending their death. You're intending to save your life when they're coming at attacking you, just like you would for a guilty person trying to attack you. It's under the principle of double effect. If they're turning into a zombie, they're not actively attacking you at that moment. So you can't kill them just for the sake of sparing them suffering. You would be compassionate. You would walk alongside them in their suffering. And then you would confront whatever issues arise after their death. So I know that's, you know, for some people, that's a silly thing to talk about. Zombies aren't real. Like, well, the principles still apply in certain cases. Like if somebody is on drugs, maybe they were drugged and then they get a gun and they're going to start running around shooting people. You may in that moment have to use lethal force, even though they're not intending, even though they're not guilty of a crime. They are still a threat to other people, and the duty to protect life allows you to act in those cases. So you wouldn't just let someone just run amok. You would try to contain them with nonviolent means and non-fatal means, and use a fatal mean as a last resort, something you foresee their death, but you don't intend it. All right, so that was a lot there. Let's try something a little easier. What did you think of the Justice League Snyder Cut? Haven't seen it yet. I have little kids, and I don't have time to watch a four-hour movie. But what's hard for me is I don't know if I'm going to watch it, because I usually watch reviews of movies before I sit down to watch them, because I have no time for movies. And I've heard that it's okay. It's, you know, it's better than Justice League, but that's not saying much. Justice League was terrible. I tried watching it on an airplane, couldn't do it. Well, I kept fast-forwarding. It's awful. So, so bad. I mean, the Justice League cartoons animated series. Justice League animated series is so, so much better. Even like the CW and their crossovers, which are kind of cheesy, is better than Zack Snyder's Justice League. So, oh, my goodness. But yeah, I've just heard it's better, but I don't know if I have the 4 hours to commit. Maybe one day in the future. Here's the next one. Is there a hymn that you wish you never had to hear at Mass again? On the flip side, what is your favorite hymn? All right, so this is a hard one. I wouldn't say that I have a favorite hymn per se, or a least favorite one. It's going to be a spectrum. But I will say the ones that I enjoy tend to be timeless and not written in a way to be kind of, I don't know what's the word, show-offy. That they're really more humble. They're humble hymns that don't have as much range in the notes, but also are very profound. They're very profound in their lyrics to help you to meditate on the mysteries of God. I love the hymns of Divine Liturgy. There's Trent talking about Divine Liturgy again. Yeah, I really like it. I love going to a Byzantine Catholic church. Come to St. Basil the Great in Dallas if you're ever here. 10 a.m. Divine Liturgy. We'd love to have you. But they're just so intentive about it. I mean, I love now that it's Easter, so I can sing, "Come, let us sing joyfully to the Lord. Let us proclaim God our Savior. O Son of God, risen from the dead, save us who sing to you." I like that. I like just actively participating in liturgy in that way. I love "Set aside all earthly cares. Come now, let us set aside all earthly cares." We repeat it over and over again before the liturgy of the Eucharist to focus your mind on the Eucharist. There's also other Western hymns that I like. I think it's the breastplate of St. Patrick. "Christ, to the right of me and to the left of me, beneath me, above me." When it's the focus is on God and entering into the mystery of God, I like it. When it sounds like an 80s jingle or like a show tune, I don't like it. It's kind of like the Star Spangled Banner. Like, we have a weird national anthem, like the Star Spangled Banner. Like, the national anthem should be something we can all get together and sing because we're proud of our country. But only like 1% of people can really sing the Star Spangled Banner. Like, the Star Spangled Banner exists to show off how good you are at singing "Rockets Red Glare." I mean, we just have one person in the stadium who sings it, and the rest of us are supposed to just like cheer along with them, when it should be something more communal and simple. Now, I don't know any hymns that are as complicated as the Star Spangled Banner that we might sing at Mass, but there are some I feel like they're just almost kind of performative or showy, so I don't prefer them as much. If you like them, if they lead you closer to God, God bless you. That's good. Different strokes for different folks. That's okay. There's lots of different things that will lead people to God, and some are better for other people. They don't do that for me. Okay, they just don't do that for me. So, the Table of Plenty, I'm not a fan. It sounds like I'm in like a subpar musical. "Come to the feast of heaven and earth. Come to the table of plenty." And like I'm entering onto the scene and the backup dancers come in. "God will provide for all that we need." If I feel like I can get show tune, although I love musicals. In fact, I'm thinking of doing a Free for All Friday soon, the Secret World of musicals. Because when I was in theater, one of my favorite things was musicals. That's super fun. I love musicals. I just don't want to have the feeling that I love musicals and I love 80s television shows. You know, I love cheesy 80s TV show theme songs. I love their cheesiness in a particular time and place. But I don't want that when I'm in the midst of worshiping God in the liturgy. So I'm not as not as big a fan. But hey, if they move you to contemplate the divine, more power to you. Okay, moving on. What do you think of cryptocurrency? Do you own any? So cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, I like Dogecoin because the dog is cute. I don't super understand it. I mean, I get the basics of it, but I don't like it when I ask people, so what is cryptocurrency? Should I get involved in cryptocurrency? And the first preface is, well, cryptocurrency is great, but you have to remember money's not real. And yeah, money is a unit of value. We don't have a gold standard anymore. Money does not reflect a particular amount of silver or gold. It just reflects our confidence in the economic system in that country where we're doing a transaction. But, you know, so with Bitcoin, people still say, well, money's not real. I'm like, yeah, well, no, I have a certain amount of money in my bank account. It feels really real to me. I would prefer to not lose it. So I don't own any cryptocurrency. Several years ago, I was friends with people who were super into Bitcoin mining. So Bitcoin is this digital currency. I'm not going to be able to explain it well, but it's something that is decentralized as a currency. Its value is not related to any particular country or nation. It's related to its scarcity that exists in computer software code. And you can use computers to mine Bitcoin to create it to reduce the scarcity. But as more people want to use Bitcoin, its value will go up. So we had a big boom in Bitcoin not too long ago. I had friends who were involved in mining it. You have these computers that are running to crack codes on the internet to release more Bitcoins. But they've gotten out of that because there are whole countries like Russia. And like in Russia, they have computers in Siberia in these giant warehouses mining Bitcoins. Like if you're at your computer trying to mine Bitcoin, it's not profitable anymore because the amount of energy it takes to run your computer, you need multiple hard drives to do this, CPUs. You have to also use electricity to run it. You have to cool it. You have to run air conditioning or you have to cool your system so it doesn't overheat. Nowadays, you can't make money mining Bitcoins at home on your little computer because the amount of money you get from it is less than the amount it takes to run the computer itself to mine the Bitcoins. If you don't understand it, that's fine. I don't understand it either. But I know Russia and other places have had these giant Bitcoin mining operations where like it's in Siberia. So like these huge computers are cooled by the Arctic weather and can get the stuff that nobody else can. So it's interesting, but it's not something that I'm willing to invest in. When it comes to my investment strategies, I like long-term, low risk. That's what I like to be involved in. When it comes to the spectrum between investing and gambling, I would like to be far away from gambling. When I go to Vegas, I play $20 on the slots, and as soon as I get above $20, I quit. That's what I do. That is my strategy. So let's see. We got a few more questions here. I read a book where humans could be created by technology via vat-grown bodies and minds with procedurally generated memories. These are unique humans, so they aren't clones. Would they have eternal souls? What other moral implications can you draw from this situation? Well, I would have to learn more about what is being created. If what is created artificially is a human organism, then it would have a soul, because in order to be a human being, it would have to have a rational soul to animate it. Now, God infuses the soul directly into each of us, but he doesn't check to make sure we were created in a morally licit way before he does that. So you can be conceived, come into existence, and receive your soul if you were created through an act of adultery, an act of rape, if you were conceived in an in vitro fertilization laboratory. So there you have, taking genetic material, sperm and egg, combined in the laboratory, you get the human being. You would have a soul if you were cloned, if you took a skin cell, took the DNA out of it, put those 46 chromosomes into an empty egg, zapped with electricity, you would have a new human being. Maybe it could be grown in a vat. Well, I guess it would be like an artificial womb. It would be created. There's a movie a while back, I think it was Jude Law and Scarlett Johansson, called The Island. And it's about people. The twist is already telegraphed long before you find out. But it's about an island. It's a supposed island. It's not really an island, where people live and they're told the outside world is contaminated and they have to stay underground to survive. But they're all actually clones of wealthy people in a normal world who want them around for spare body parts. And they're grown there and they're brainwashed. And there's actually a scene where they kill the clones in the artificial wombs, and it It actually is a good argument against a visceral illustrative argument against abortion. So yeah, if you, however you create a human being, if what you create is a human organism, I would say that we have relative confidence or moral certainty that it would, we should at least presume that it has an immortal soul, especially if it is capable of acting in human ways. And so we should treat it accordingly. And that's why we shouldn't be creating human beings outside of the marital act. So we got a few more questions here. I might be running a little bit over, but that's okay. That's okay. How do you answer the charge that the Gospels and the other books in the New Testament are anti-Semitic? I'd say, well, that's kind of strange that they're anti-Semitic, since everything in the New Testament, except for Luke and Acts, was written by Jews. Jesus was a Jew. It's how could I don't know how you'd be anti-Semitic when Jews were writing this. The first Christians were Jewish. They wanted to preserve different Jewish traditions and even festivals and allow people to celebrate them. Most people think the New Testament is anti-Semitic. Like they'll read the Gospel of John and it will say, and they did this and they were afraid of the Jews and they were concerned the Jews would do this. But this is not saying that there are the Jews and the Christians, because the first Christians saw themselves as faithful Jews who had found the Messiah. When the New Testament talks about, especially like John, when it talks about the Jews, you know it's not talking about all Jews, because remember the story of the man born blind from birth. It said that the Jewish leaders go to his parents and they say, you know, has he always been blind? And they don't want to get involved. They say, look, he's of age, you go talk to him. And it says, parenthetically, they said this for fear of the Jews. But that's weird because they are Jewish. Jews there, me, is a term that refers to the Jewish leadership. So it would be like if I said, I can't believe the Republicans did this, or I can't believe the Democrats want to abort children up until the ninth month of birth for any reason. Like, let's take that one as an example. The Democrats want abortion without restriction. When I say that specifically, I'm talking about Democratic leadership in Washington, D.C., because I'm sure there are many people who identify as Democrats who they may even support abortion, but not necessarily all 9 months for any reason. And there are people who identify as Democrat who are pro-life. So like when I say that, I can't possibly be talking about every single registered Democrat. And they're not even the ones doing this. I'm talking about the ones in Washington passing the laws. So I'm talking about the leadership. So if we say like the Republicans, the Democrats, the Americans, the Iranians, when we talk about these things, we're usually talking about the leadership of a group, not the group itself. And in the first century, different Jewish schools of thought could be so mean to each other. Like the New Testament is really mild. When you read in the Dead Sea Scrolls, certain Jewish camps ask God to curse other Jewish schools of thought. And the New Testament never asks God to curse the Jewish people in this way. In fact, in Romans chapter 11, Paul makes it very clear he has a hope that all Israel will be saved, which, I mean, different ways of interpreting that, but I think one way to say that all that people who come from all different tribes of Israel can be saved, that God desires the salvation of, he wants everyone to be saved. Not everyone will be saved, but the offer is available to everyone who is there, regardless of ethnicity, nationality, things like that. Who does the intro voice to your podcast? It sounds so much like Laura. It's not Laura. It's not Laura. Though I'd love for Laura to do one. Maybe she'll do a special one here or there. No, you know what? I texted to find an answer to this for recording. I couldn't get it. We went to a website, I think it's called Sound Jungle, where you can just get voiceover artists and you pay them. They do a recording for you. They send it back to you and it's done. I've actually thought about doing like voiceover work just for fun. I would love to do voiceover work for like a cartoon animated series just to have a lot of fun with that. In college, I was asked to do that for a Christian puppet show video, and I did the voice of one of the puppets. He was like this like awkward teenager. Hi, geez, mister, I'm really sorry about that. Yeah, like talking through like giant metal braces, I guess. I don't know. I'm sure it was horrid, but if I ever find it, I'll post it online for you there. Let's see, we got a few more here. Top three favorite science fiction TV series. I will go with Star Trek, The Next Generation, make it so, The Twilight Zone, and I don't know, I think those are really like my top two. Like, I never got into Doctor Who. I know. I mean, Jimmy Akin and I have a lot in common, but he definitely knows a lot about the Doctor, And I really don't. I know he travels through time in a big blue telephone booth, and it's just the Doctor. And he has his companions, and exterminate. I know enough to get by in a Doctor Who conversation, barely. But I would say when I grew up, Twilight Zone, original Twilight Zone, and Star Trek The Next Generation were my favorite science fiction series. And the last one here. Before we moved to Texas, you talked about how great it was that they had a separate power grid. Have your thoughts on this change after seeing how much more it struggled during the blackouts, the distributed nature of the larger grids? No, not really. I mean, it was certainly unexpected. I mean, though there was a big freeze back in 2011, I think power companies should have learned from. So I'm a bit peeved that they didn't learn from that and that they weren't upfront in the beginning that this could happen. Even if they were upfront, I think a lot of people, they just said the day before, hey, we might have blackouts for 2 or 3 days. There would have been a ridiculous run on the grocery stores and people would have panicked. And I don't know. I'm not an expert in how cities should manage disasters in that way. I just like to study how individuals should manage and prepare for disasters. And I would just say here that this was a disaster. It was a natural disaster. It reached, temperatures were reached that were completely unheard of. It would be like if you lived in a super cold part of the country and it was 119 degrees, 120 degrees between 115 and 120 for like 4 or 5 days. And you're just not, and you, nobody has air conditioning because we don't have insulation here. It was like negative 13 with wind chill a few months ago here, you know, and then we had a pipe burst and we're still getting that fixed. But I mean, so it was a natural disaster. Things happen, but you know what? When I saw people around me, people really pulled together. And it was a great attitude to be able to see amongst others. We should always mourn the loss of life, and the damage to property is always a difficult thing. But at the end of the day, I don't think it would have changed that much, really. There were other parts of the country that lost their electricity for a significant amount of time as well, just didn't get as much news time. So no, I think it's fine. I think that it's still good. And also, we also have to look at the possibility if they're, you know, it's like, okay, if I'm on the larger grid, it's easier for me to get power if my part of the grid goes down. But the larger the grid gets, the more you can have cascading power failures. In 2003, there was that big failure. It started in Ohio and it stretched all the way up to Canada. So it's bigger. It can help you in times of problems, but it can also be a liability if there's a cascading series of failures. So no, I still like Texas, and you know, there's pluses and minuses to everything. But overall, I think it's been a plus to be here in the great state of Texas. So random open mailbag, everybody. Was a lot of fun to share with you. If you want to submit a question for a future episode, be sure to go to trendhornpodcast.com. Go to Homeschool Connections to check out my courses that are available there. I'll probably launch a website soon, trendhornclasses.com, for all the stuff I'm teaching, but I'd love to share with everybody. But this has been a lot of fun. Hope you enjoyed it. Go to trendhornpodcast.com. And don't forget to have a very blessed week.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit trendhornpodcast.com.